move on to the Dirac equation. I suppose I should warn you, first of all, that there is no derivation of the Dirac equation. It's simply something which I can make plausible, and you can make believable by performing experiments, in principle, even if not in practice, which agree with what you get from the Dirac equation. So plausibility is the best that I can do. And a starting point to trying to motivate what the Dirac equation is to think about how you derive the Schrödinger equation. Of course, the word derive doesn't mean anything there either. It's how you think about the Schrödinger equation. So for the Schrödinger equation, one way to do this, is definitely not the Heisenberg way of doing it, is to say, well, you've got the energy of something comes in two parts, a kinetic piece and a potential energy piece. So that's very Newtonian. And then you translate this into the language of operators and wave functions. And so you'd say kinetic energy. Well, that's p squared over 2m in an unrelativistic setting. And that goes to minus I h bar del all squared. That's momentum squared divided by 2m. The potential energy is whatever you want it to be, some function of position, v of x, which translates to v of x. And then the energy, what you mean by that, is the total energy, or possibly the Hamiltonian, something of that form. And you translate that into IH bar d by dt. And then you wind up with the Schrödinger equation, which reads IH bar d by dt, acting on psi, is minus H bar squared delta. To over 2m del squared psi plus v psi. So you have turned this thing into an equation. Now, how in the world would you ever generalize that to special relativity? And that's all we can actually do in this today. Well, the obvious thing to do is to write down the relativistic form of this expression. So you would say, the relativistic form of this expression perhaps you'd say that e squared was equal to p squared c squared plus m squared c to the fourth. Be the best that you can do. E is the energy. P here, I mean the spatial momentum, and I'm going to underline it so that I don't get it confused with something else. So P, of course, is the three-vector momentum. And M will be the rest mass of some particle. We don't know how to include potential energy in this kind of expression, because energy, if you think about it, is the zeroth component of a four-vector, whereas when we wrote potential energy here, it looked like a scalar. And so obviously, there is something quite dramatically amiss here. There's another problem which you have to face immediately. But if you stare at this and you want to make it relativistically invariant, you're supposed to unify the spatial coordinates and time into a four-vector, xA. But There's obviously a problem here because you've got two derivatives in space and one derivative in time, and so there's no way in which we're ever going to be able to get this without doing something a bit hokey. If you come over here, you will see that you have sort of got round that problem by ending up with an e squared equals something. This expression too has problems, because if I ask you what is the energy given some momentum and rest mass, you would solve this equation and say E equals the square root of p squared c squared plus m squared c to the fourth, and we'd all be happy until you realize that there are two solutions to that equation. One has positive energy and one has negative energy. You can't have negative energy. Negative energy, relativistically, will give you the opportunity to mine energy and get energy for nothing. So these negative energy states are, shall we say, problematic. And the problem is, of course, that this was quadratic in E and P, and that really doesn't look very good. If it was linear in derivatives, or linear in energies and momentum, you would not have this problem. Classically, of course, it doesn't really matter if you do this. You just go ahead and do it, and you would just say, well, I'm going to choose the positive energy things. But quantum mechanically, you have to look at all solutions, and these negative energy states will give you a problem. There was a question.
Yes, you mentioned earlier that having E squared helped us avoid the problem of the different order derivatives and T in space.
Right.
And I didn't understand how that helps us.
Sorry. Oh, I will do an example. So, let's suppose that we take this relationship here. I'm going to do this anyway. And just try to do what we think we're supposed to do. Where have all the erasers gone? This is some kind of conspiracy. Back where? Oh, there. Thank you. Before I go any further, perhaps I ought to ask your permission to do something. Can I put C equal to 1? Good. So let's just translate this thing without thinking into operator language, simply because it is rather illuminating. So every time you see E, you write IH bar D by DT. Every time you see a spatial momentum, you write minus IH bar grad, and what you will end up with is E squared, that's minus H bar squared D2 by DT squared, is equal to P squared, that's minus H bar squared del squared, plus M squared, acting on something like psi, and we end up with an equation that looks like that. This is a good equation, sort of. Let's rewrite it as I'm going to divide by h bar squared. This is sometimes known as the Klein-Gordon equation. And it is sort of nice and relativistic. If you just look at this expression here, this thing is just a four-dimensional wave operator. with which you are probably familiar from the world of electrodynamics, I hope. So that at least makes a certain amount of sense. And it's kind of nice to rewrite this thing in the following way. Eta AB del A del B minus m squared over h bar squared acting on phi equals 0. And that looks even more relativistic. Eta is the metric on Minkowski space. So it's the thing that is diagonal minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. And this thing here is a collection of things which reads d by dt and then grad. So this thing I want to regard as a zeroth component of that. And these are the spatial components of that. But my guess is that Rob Myers did something like that to deal with general relativity. Please nod and say yes and reassure me. If true, of course. So this is kind of familiar. The trouble with this is that attempts to interpret this phi as a wave function fail. Yes?
OK. That eta AB, what is that? So, okay. So,
what does this mean?
LA, LB, those both act on, or sorry.
Those act on phi.
All right. So, I just can't parse this expression. One way to say it is, okay, so del B acts on phi, so you have a smooth function, another smooth function. Then del A acts on phi. That smooth function turns into another smooth function.
The question is, what does this really mean? Let me write it another way. Okay. It might help you.
Right, but like, to do this relativistically,
I mean, you use a summation convention here.
Yeah.
Let me write it another way then. Sum over all possible A's and B's. The only ones that aren't zero is when A coincides with B. So you'll get A eta 0, 0, d 0, d 0, plus eta 1, 1, d 1, d 1, plus eta 2, 2, d 2, d 2.
Yeah. Is there a natural way to write this in terms of, like, relativistic things, like covariant derivative or something? Or is this, like...
Oh.
You just have to... Like, it's not at all obvious to me, for example, that if you change, you know, if you change directions, you're taking derivatives along, this whole expression hasn't changed.
If you would like me to write this in a covariant-looking way, then I should write it like this. Would that help?
Sir?
Would that help?
You're in flat space.
We're in flat space, and we're always in Cartesian coordinates cx, y, z.
Right.
That's the conventional way of doing things in special relativity. So you don't really need to think about this thing in any coordinate system other than the obvious tx, y, z coordinates. If you ever needed to, you could write it like this.
So these equations then don't generalize to non-flat metrics? Is that...
This equation does generalize to none factors, and this is its generalization.
Okay.
Because, you see, if you did this in flat space, it would just collapse down to this. But flat space in Cartesian coordinates. Of course, he's right in saying that this thing is not generally coordinate invariant. And it really is that. But because you always tend to use tx, y, z coordinates to do things in special relativity, you really can write it like this and not get too worried. In the case of the Klein-Gordon equation, it is easy to generalize to curved space. And indeed, that's a generalization. For the Dirac equation, it is amazingly complicated. I really don't want to do it. perhaps someone else will do it at some point. Now, so the problem with this is that when you come to interpret phi as a wave function, you will discover that you end up with negative probabilities. And this is a major obstacle. The cure for this particular problem ought to be explained by David Tong next week. Dirac was able to solve this problem, which is why Dirac is famous. So we're not going to pursue this, but merely notice that this kind of thing here does make a certain limited amount of sense, in the sense that it is a relativistically sensible thing, even though it's not quantum mechanically very sensible. Now, let's see. I want to consider momentum as a four vector. So my four vector of momentum is going to be energy and then spatial momentum as a P. If I talk about momentum as a four vector with its index downstairs, this is the same thing as eta AB PB, with the usual rule for lowering indices, in which case it is going to be minus E spatial 3 vector P. If anyone is not comfortable with this, now is the time to say so, because things will rapidly get worse. This condition here can then be rewritten nicely as TA PA is equal to m plus m squared is equal to 0. So that's the form of the momentum that I will usually use. Sometimes it is called the mass shell condition. Now we can just deal with the Dirac equation. Dirac's basic idea was to say, if you have got something which looks like this, and you are troubled by having second derivative terms, like you are here, you take its square root. Pretty reasonable. Now, so if this was the form p squared plus m squared, acting on some wave function, and you took its square root, well, you don't quite take its square root. I'll get my signs right. I have great trouble with signs at this point. So I'd like to write it like that. I haven't really quite taken its square root, because that's not p minus im is not the square root of it. But you can think of this as being, if you like, some operator O, and this is its summation conjugate, which, if you think quantum mechanically, is the best thing you can do if you want to take a square root. So Dirac said, well, what you should do then is just to consider this equation instead. Well, try to consider this equation. P minus IM acting on psi. This is not his form of the Dirac equation, because we need to translate it into something sensible. This obviously doesn't work, because P here looks like a scalar, whereas in actual fact it's supposed to be a four vector. So what would you do? You would probably say that you were trying to write an equation that looked like that, which means you've got to find something to put there to soak up the index. What is it that you're going to put? Recall that the obvious generalization of PA would be to write PA is that. So, in the absence of anything better to do, Dirac basically said, well, I have no idea what to put there, so I'll just put something there. And that's the Dirac equation. Now, we had some discussion of units earlier. I used units such that with C is equal to 1. I would also like to use units such that H bar is equal to 1. Does anyone object to that? It will make your life much easier. It will also make my life much easier. So here is a Dirac equation. Our only problem now is to understand whether or not those symbols can be made sense of. In particular, what is this? No. There was an I here, but there was an I there, and I took it away. If you are wondering why there are no I's there, it's because my metric signature convention is minus plus plus plus. If I had done what you find in some other rather tedious books, old particle physics books, you will get my I's everywhere, and you'll have a very nasty time. And space will be all backwards, because space is not with a minus. Enough of that, so that's why there are no I's there. Well, the way to find out what this is just to ask... Oh, it's interesting to know what he thought it was. You might try to interpret this as just simply some coefficient, a number. I don't know what he thought. So let's square this equation. That's the analog of multiplying by P plus IM, which is the step that we did before. So, can this ever be sensible? Multiply this out. There's a gamma B, dB, gamma A, dA, a minus M, gamma A, dA, a plus M, gamma A, dA. So that's nice, goes away. Minus M squared, acting on psi, equals 0. Let's multiply this thing out. It reads gamma A, gamma B, dB, dA, dB, minus m squared, psi, equals 0. And you will notice that these two things are symmetric under the interchange of A and B. So I could write this, replace this by a half of gamma A, gamma B, plus gamma B, gamma A, dA, dB, minus m squared, acting on psi, equals 0. Because dA dB is symmetric under the interchange of A and B, which I will always write like that. Yeah?
From the second to third line, how do we know that gamma A is constant with respect to B?
A good question. The answer is luck. This only works in flat coordinates in Minkowski space, x, y, z, t. If you want to do this in curved space, then gammas will depend on x's, and you have to do something more complicated. please don't ask me to do this. You won't enjoy it. What's worse, I won't either. So, you would like this to turn into wave operator, because you already know that that's about the only thing that's consistent with the equation that we have at the extreme left. So this thing is the wave operator. What does that mean? That means that gamma A, gamma B, plus gamma B, gamma A, has got to be equal to 2 times e to AB, or you are sunk. Now we can all see why Dirac was clever. If these things were numbers, there's no way in which this would ever work. Can you think of two numbers which obey this? And the answer is, of course not. Put A equal to 0 and B equal to X, then this is 0. And you're asking for two numbers such that gamma 0, gamma X, plus gamma X, gamma 0 is equal to 0. Well, there ain't no such thing. So you can't do that. You look very puzzled.
So it could be like, if you add something to something and get a linear map, it's not a, the somethings aren't numbers. So like, why is this even an issue?
Because it is now 2009 and then it was 1928.
Okay.
So we all know how to solve this problem. You imagine that these things are matrices.
Shouldn't there be a minus sign somewhere?
Sorry?
Shouldn't there be a minus sign somewhere? Because we originally had a plus m squared and not a minus m squared in that equation.
This thing, PA is minus IH bar DA. So this thing, PA, PA, is equal to minus I times minus I is minus h bar squared del squared. This is del squared, so this is minus p squared minus m squared. And that reads energy squared minus spatial momentum squared minus m squared, which has the correct sign to go over there. So the answer is no. I had, rather than try to copy this out of somewhere, I tried to figure it all out for myself in an attempt to get all my signs consistently right. And I believe I have done so. But if there are sign problems, please tell me, and we can fix them. I believe my conventions are all consistent, but not necessarily consistent with anybody else. So this sign is correct. It's always worth asking questions like that, because sometimes they turn out not to be quite what you expect. So these things are matrices. There is, of course, a slight problem with that. Now, if we go back to the Dirac equation, gamma A dA plus m acting on psi, if you thought that that was a matrix, you have to decide what that is. Well, presumably it's M times the unit matrix. Then you have to decide what this is. So this has got to be some kind of column vector.
In that, why does gamma A partial A have to be a matrix? Because we're contracting out by... So you're saying that
each gamma is a matrix.
Oh.
So, you see here, what have you got? You've got a gamma 0, a gamma 1, a gamma 2, and a gamma 3.
Okay.
Each one of those has got to be a matrix, because it can't be a number.
I see. I see.
Okay.
So, there's two additional indices we need.
Which we have not written down.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay. That's what I was going to ask earlier, when we factored, it seems like we should have added indices when we did, but we really should have, and we only realized it.
We'll just regard these as matrices and use matrix multiplication. If you wanted to do that, there's nothing stopping you doing that. If you really wanted to use not matrix notation, but put in the indices, then typically what you would do is to say that it's got two different kinds of index. So this relationship would now read so these would correspond to the rows and columns of that particular matrix. Of course, you sum over beta. So these things, betas, alphas, and gamma, are usually referred to as Dirac indices or spinner indices. But you are much better off suppressing them wherever you can. You really don't want to do that. Now, of course, this doesn't tell you what the dimensionality of these things are. At the moment, they're just matrices, and we haven't figured out how big these matrices are. If they were one-by-one matrices, they would be numbers, and we already know that doesn't work. And by exhaustive messing around, you will discover that 2x2 and 3x3 doesn't work, but 4x4 does. There are many different equivalent collections of gamma matrices. Yes?
You said gamma cannot be a number.
Cannot be an ordinary number, no.
But if I choose a gamma I equal 1 and gamma 0 equal I, then that equation is satisfied.
Gamma 0
equal I.
Is equal to I, yes. Gamma 1?
Gamma 1 to 3 is equal to 1.
Then this, look at the 0 I component of this. Gamma 0 1 plus gamma 1 0 is supposed to be equal to 2 eta 0 1. This is 0. And these are both I, so that doesn't work.
Open over the diagonal element.
You want these along the diagonal or something. Still doesn't work. Because you're saying multiply by that. These two matrices commute, so this still doesn't work.
Well, if all you need is commutivity, I suppose you could use quaternions.
You could. That's almost what you do. So let me show you something which does work, rather than things that don't work. So, the Dirac matrices defined by star, call this equation star, have many representations, but they are all equivalent. So I'm going to pick one representation that makes life rather easy, and in particular makes it easy to compare with something non-relativistic. I didn't have to do this. There are many other things that you could do. Everyone seems to have their own favorite collection of gamma matrices. But here are mine. gamma 0 with its index upstairs, I will take to be I naught, naught minus I. Where this 1 is a unit 2 by 2 matrix. Gamma I will take to be 0, sigma, sigma, 0. Where these are the 2 by 2 Pauli matrices. That we are all familiar with from spin half systems. But of course the Pauli matrices don't have a unique representation either. So sigma 1 will be equal to 0, 1, 1, 0. Sigma 2 is 0 minus I, 0. Sigma 3 is 1, 0, 0 minus 1. And if you ever need to multiply two of them together, sigma I, sigma j is delta ij plus epsilon ijk, sigma k, and a factor of I. This being the three-dimensional alternating symbol. So those are my collection of gamma matrices. We ought to check that they really do work. It's not as hard as it looks. Well, gamma 0 squared, that's I naught naught minus I, times I naught naught minus I, gives you a minus 1 in the top left-hand corner, nothing there, and a minus 1 there. So that gives you the right thing. You will notice that this matrix is anti-Hermitian, meaning if you take the Hermitian conjugate, you get minus itself. With my sign conventions, that is always true. What about gamma I, gamma j, plus gamma j, gamma I? Well, this is equal to eta 0, 0, which is equal to minus 1. This thing is supposed to be 2 delta ij, so is it? Naught, sigma I, naught, naught, sigma j, naught, plus the same thing with I and j swapped around. So that gives you a long, in the top left-hand corner, sigma j, sigma I, 0 here, 0 here, and then sigma I, sigma j, to which you add the same thing with I and j swapped around. And then both of these are 2 delta ij, because that's the anti-symmetric bit and that's the symmetric bit, times the unit matrix. So this is equal to 2 eta ij. Then you have got to do gamma 0, gamma I. Plus gamma I, gamma 0. These two matrices have got to anti-commute. So the question is, do they? I, 0, 0, minus I, 0, sigma I, 0, plus 0, sigma I, 0, I, naught, naught, minus I, is equal to, let's see. So in the top left-hand corner, you get nothing. Both of them. in the top right-hand corner, you get I sigma I from here plus nothing. In the bottom left-hand corner from this one, you get minus I sigma I. And then down here, you get nothing. And then from this one, you get that times that up here, so you still get nothing. Here, you get minus I sigma I. Here, you'll get plus I sigma I from there. So you get zero. That's also what you expect. These gamma matrices, or some representation of the gamma matrices, are so important that we ought to record them for posterity here, out of the way where I will not erase them. Gamma 0 is I naught naught minus I. Gamma space is naught sigma I naught. There was a comment earlier about quaternions. These things are almost the same thing as the imaginary quaternions. It is perhaps just as well that Dirac did not know about quaternions, otherwise we would have had a different kind of mess to deal with. You can do it using quaternions. Often, we will have to lower the space-time index on the gamma matrices. If we do that, gamma naught, of course, will change sign, so you get minus I, 0, 0, plus I. But gamma I, with its index downstairs, is the same. I guess I should have asked this earlier, but what sign conventions did Rob Myers use for the metric?
-plus.
This one's. Okay. So that statement then is not puzzling. All right. Now, what's the next thing to do? Everyone knows there are implicit 2x2 matrices in there. So there is one problem that we have to deal with. We have a wave function psi, which contains now four components, which I will call chi and capital phi, each of which are two-dimensional column vectors. Now this looks like almost like a spin-half system. This is a two-dimensional column vector, so you would be tempted to say, if you're talking about spin-half, then this has got something to do with the usual kind of wave function for a spin-half object, leaving this phi as mysterious. What we do know, however, is that we can nevertheless treat this equation and see if we can figure out what's going on by looking at the non-relativistic limit. It is, after all, only in the non-relativistic limit that we understand what this has got to do with anything else. So let's look at the non-relativistic limit in a simple way to start with. And then we will see what to do about these wave functions. So we're aiming to look at the non-relativistic limit. Of gamma A del A plus M. Do I mean plus M or minus M? I can never remember this. I think that I mean plus M. I think, no, I don't. I mean plus M. I said it right. the way to do this is to write out all the components in detail. So we have over here everything we need to do that. So let's write it out. It's going to be some 2x2 matrix. This is really a 4x4 matrix. It's a secret. Every entry is 2x2, acting on psi. And what do we get? In the top left-hand corner, gamma 0, d 0, we're going to get an I d by dt from here. Then there will be a plus m from there. Then, in the top right-hand corner, there will be a sigma dot spatial gradient, which I'll write like that. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by that object.
But where is that?
Hmm? This comes from the top right-hand corner. So you have sigma I dotted with del I.
That's what we're talking about.
We're writing out all of these terms. So it's gamma naught d naught plus gamma I di, I being the spatial indices. So gamma naught d naught, you look at gamma naught, there's an I up here. It multiplies d by dt. Then there's an m. So this m is multiplied by the unit matrix, we get an m here. Now let's look at the lower right-hand corner. Here there's a minus I. So there's a minus I d by dt coming from that term. And then there's another plus m. From the spatial gamma i's, you see there are only the top right-hand corner and bottom left. They're both plus sigma. So you'll end up with a sigma dot del in these two corners. That acts on the column vector chi phi equals 0. So what you end up with is coupled differential equations for these two things. Let's write them out explicitly. You will get I d by dt plus m acting on chi plus sigma dot grad acting on phi equals 0. That's the first row. Then you'll get sigma dot grad acting on chi plus minus I d by dt plus m acting on phi equals 0. So you'll see we get coupled equations. Phi and chi are not linearly independent. In Dirac's first thoughts on the subject of the Dirac equation, that was it. He then forgot about phi and just concentrated on chi. I'm sorry, the other way around. No, that way around. Forgot about phi, concentrated on chi, and said that was a 2x1 column vector, and therefore it made sense to describe a spin-half object. To see that we get something sane, what you have to do is to eliminate phi from these equations. So the way to do that is to multiply the top, let's call it 1 and 2, minus I d by dt plus m. Multiply 2 by sigma dot grad. Now notice that these are operators, so you have to multiply on the left, but fortunately they commute because sigma is just constant and m doesn't depend on space. So Oh, they do commute. And subtract. That will have the effect of getting rid of the terms involving phi. What do we get? Minus I d by dt plus m into I d by dt plus m acting on chi plus minus I d by dt plus m sigma dot grand acting on phi equals zero. That's this thing multiplied by that, and multiply this one by that. Sigma dot grad, acting on chi, plus sigma dot grad, minus I d by dt, plus m, acting on phi, is equal to zero. So that is the same as that. So if you subtract, it will go away. And you will get d2 by dt squared from this acting on that, acting on chi, plus mi d by dt minus mi d by dt, so I get nothing from there, plus m squared. Then I get minus sigma dot grad, acting on chi equals zero. Sigma dot grad is another way of writing sigma I, sigma j, di, dj. Partial derivatives of commute, so this is the same thing as a half. Of sigma I, sigma j, sigma j, sigma I, and it's a symmetric piece. But this is delta ij with a factor of 2, so the whole thing is just del squared. Usually written, I should call that del I squared, usually written as del squared that way. You might argue that that was a disappointing result, because all we've ended up is back with the Klein-Gordon equation. But if you think about it, all we've really done is shown that the Klein-Gordon equation is consistent with the Dirac equation, which we already knew. The Dirac equation is something stronger. Furthermore, you would never have guessed from staring at the Klein-Gordon equation that these were 2 by 1 matrices. So it doesn't really give them back the Klein-Gordon equation. Chi is a column vector. And all we have shown is that Dirac implies this equation. We have not done the other way around. In fact, you can't. So Dirac implies this kind of Klein-Gordon equation, but not the other way around. If you wanted to see that this was in fact consistent with what you think about energy and momentum, non-relativistically, you can do that very quickly. What we had here was, well, it was there, was essentially E plus M times minus E plus M plus P squared equals zero. That's another way of writing this equation. D by dt is IE. So this thing is the operator form of this. But if you think non-relativistically, then that's obviously the right kind of thing, because this thing is, roughly speaking, 2m. That is non-relativistically minus p squared over 2m, because this is minus the total energy plus the rest mass energy. And that's the same thing as minus the kinetic energy. And then this is the spatial momentum, so it gives you exactly what you expect. Now, that's all fine, except that this form of the Dirac equation is completely useless. It just tells you you've got a free particle interacting with nothing, with no potentials. It doesn't tell you what this has got to do with any other bit of physics. So we need to have the analog of a potential, but we already know there is no analog of a potential. What you can do, and does make perfect sense, even if you want to do something like the hydrogen atom, is to couple this to the electromagnetic field. So I started to think about how to do this, and the trouble is I don't quite know what you have already seen and what you haven't. One way of coupling anything to an electromagnetic field, if it has got charge Q, is everywhere where you see the momentum, you replace it by P minus Q times the vector potential. Then it occurred, this is known as a minimal coupling procedure. And doing that kind of thing is popular in Hamiltonian mechanics courses, but then it occurred to me that perhaps you hadn't done it. Has anyone not seen that before? Tricky. Let's see. Where is the best place to learn about that? Those who just said they had not seen it before, do you know how to extract the equations of motion of a particle from its Lagrangian? Okay, in that case, I can give you a problem that will work, that will illustrate it absolutely without ambiguity. So in the tutorials this afternoon, they will tell you before you go off and see the doctors again. So, Colin, make sure that I remember to tell you how to do that. Now, in relativity, you don't really think of magnetic fields and electric fields as being separate. Actually, I hope you all know this as well. Actually, I don't see how Rob Myers could have done anything without doing this, so I'm a bit puzzled. But so when you think of the electrostatic potential phi, and the magnetic vector potential A a 3 vector, and therefore underline, you can unify these into a 4 vector potential, whose components are a space-time index, the zeroth component is phi, and the spatial components are a. Have you all seen that before? No. Good. So to get my conventions about E and B right, which is what we will need, let's look at the electromagnetic field strength tensor. Usually written as FAB, sometimes called the Maxwell tensor, is equal to dA AB minus dB of AA. Notice that these have the indices downstairs, so this is equal to minus phi and the vector potential, in contrast to this one. Electric fields, EI, are FI0, which is the same thing as DI of A0 minus D0 of AI. DI of A0 is minus d phi dt. Can't be right. Minus grad del I phi, that's what I mean to say, minus d by dt of ai, so it's minus a vector with a dot on it, ith component. And I guess that's the familiar expression. Bi, the magnetic field, ith component, is equal to f, I'll get this right. You get it by acting with the alternating symbol on F. So this is the magnetic field. So this is equal to epsilon ijk dj of ak minus dk of aj, which is a perverse way of writing the ith component of curl A. So these things do regenerate exactly what they're supposed to produce. Now, let's look at the Dirac equation again. The Dirac equation was gamma A dA plus M equals zero. This object here was equal to I times the momentum operator, regarded as a four-dimensional object. So, boldly, we are going to say that minimal coupling tells you to do this. Replace it by PA, and then A minus QA, as a 4 vector. You could argue that given that you have got this identification of the electrostatic potential and the magnetic vector potential, this is all you could do. And indeed, it is all you can do that is consistent with the rules of special relativity. So although it seems ad hoc, it is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. So the Dirac equation in a background electromagnetic field becomes gamma A into dA minus IQAA plus M, acting on psi equals zero. This is for a particle with charge Q. Now, what we want to do is to explore some of the consequences of this. Before we do that, we have to deal with something which looks extremely alarming about this equation. No one can say anything alarming about it. I'm disappointed.
How does A act on psi?
How does A act on psi? By multiplication on the left. Exactly as you'd expect. It looks completely wrong, yes.
The indices don't.
The indices don't match up. Oh, they do. The indices are fine. We've got one up here and one down and one down. That's all right. Indices aren't a problem. So we're thinking two quantum mechanically. Think classical electromagnetism for a minute.
Depends on the gauge chosen.
Right. This equation does not look gauge invariant because I can perform a gauge transformation and A will change. So this looks completely crazy. We need to deal with that problem. So suppose you perform a gauge transformation on A. How does A change? A goes to the old A plus the four-dimensional gradient of absolutely any function you like, grad lambda. The electromagnetic field strength tensor, F, goes to the old F plus del A of del B lambda minus del B of del A lambda. But partial derivatives commute, so this does not depend on lambda. And that is a gauge transformation. You might be more used to seeing gauge transformations in the form spatial component of A goes to A plus the gradient of lambda, and A0 with its index downstairs, that's minus phi, goes to phi minus lambda dot. Possibly you don't usually think of that one. Those are the correct transformations. So that if you perform a gauge transformation on this A, the equation goes to something different. Well, what do we get? Gamma A, everywhere you see A, you replace it by grad A acting on lambda, where lambda is any function you like. This is harmless because you can change psi by multiplying it by a phase and getting back to where you started from. So if you assume that psi transforms in the following way, the new psi is equal to the old psi times e to the I q lambda, then the effect of this term, and this term doesn't give me anything, but grad A of psi prime equals e to the I q lambda grad A of psi plus I q grad A of lambda times psi. So that if psi prime is equal to this, then you get back to the original Dirac equation. But of course, an overall phase doesn't change anything physical. So physical quantities will remain invariant. So all you have to remember is that the wave function undergoes a change when you change the gauge of the field A. It's not neutral. You can't just sort of leave it alone. You've got to perform a phase transformation on the wave function if you perform a gauge transformation of A. This, too, is an absolutely universal feature of any kind of gauge theory. I don't care whether the gauge theories are electromagnetism, as they are here, or Yang-Mills theories, or the gravitational field. They're all gauge theories. A gauge transformation on the fields on A is accompanied, the potential is accompanied by a compensating phase transformation of the wave function. For decades, for reasons which are completely and utterly incomprehensible to me, it was thought that this effect was unobservable. Tomorrow I will give you an example in which it is observable. The bottom line, however, is that the Dirac equation is gauge invariant as long as you remember this fact. So it is okay to think about the solutions of this equation and their properties. So let's do more of this tomorrow. Let's stop there.